Secondhand Film Critics, your favorite source for mildly pretentious, semi-uneducated, and highly unqualified opinions on movies. I am Kayla, and I am here with my co-host,
Noah.
I should have said, I am Kayla Tenenbaum. And
I was gonna do that for mine, actually, but then I was like, it wouldn't really have matched.
Zisu or,
Noah Whitman.
Else. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Noah Cash. So many last names.
I always miss those
from.
Things. Like, I think of them after the fact. Like, I say something and then I'm like, should have said something different.
Or I think of them a day before and I'm like, that's going to be funny. And then I don't do them. And then I remember them
later
that night.
Yeah.
After lying in bed, looking at the ceiling. We're back with another Summer of West episode today. This is our second episode in this series that we're doing, going through his filmography. What was our first episode? Well, that was in June.
Yes.
And what did we cover in that one?
So in our first episode, we talked about his first two films, Rushmore and Bottle Rocket. And today, we've got some good ones for you.
Hey, I think Rushmore is a good one too. So but these are good ones. And I think these are ones, at least one of them is a really big one, but I think they're all ones I think at least some people will be pretty interested in, more than maybe because the last one I think is mostly just Rushmore is exciting, I guess, if people want to listen to that.
Yeah.
But there's at least two in these three, which is the Royal Tenenbaums, Life Aquatic, and the Darjeeling Limited, where it's these are some of people's favorites, you know?
Yeah.
At least two of these that I've seen are sometimes at the top of lists.
Yeah,
so.
Or ones that people have, Rushmore and Bottle Rocket, an average person is not likely watching one of those movies.
Yeah.
They're going to be picking one of these other bigger ones. Either one we'll talk about in the next episode or, Tenenbaums.
Yeah. It's an interesting part of his career. I'm excited to talk about it. But before we get into all of that good stuff, we have to get into our answers we got to last week's question of the week. That episode was a We've Never Seen about Point Break.
Ooh.
The classic Keanu Reeves action movie. And in the spirit of action movies, we asked you all, what non-action actor/actress do you want to see become an action star? Which we got a lot more answers than I was expecting, I think. And a lot of really various ideas going on here that we can maybe get into. If you want to skip this and get right into the episode, you can go to the timestamp in the description or the show notes, whatever. But let's get into it. What is some of our answers here?
Let's see. So Ruby said, in a better world, Army of Darkness would have launched Bruce Campbell into action stardom, but we don't live in that world. So I'll go with Timothée Chalamet, since that could potentially happen.
Yeah, I would argue it already kind of has, because I think Dune Part 1, he doesn't fight as much, but having read the book, he'll be doing a lot more fighting in the new one, and then if they make more in the series, if they do Dune Messiah or something, he'll probably, I think that's already kind of happening.
Yeah, I think it's kind of his gateway movie, it's him breaking into that world. I think it opens up the door for him. I don't think he'll ever do a superhero film.
Yeah, well, he always has that thing or that quote where he's like, that's what an act, didn't someone tell him that, never do a superhero movie or something?
Yes,
that was a piece of advice he got.
Yeah, I don't think he ever will, but I could see him doing, some other Christopher Nolan film or something else that's
Tenet Chapter 2 got announced today. I think if anyone's going to be in Tenet Chapter 2 that looks like they should be in Tenet Chapter 2.
You think it's going to be Timmy?
I think that would that would be a good fit, because I don't think Robert Pattinson would reprise, because I feel like, I mean, I don't understand the plot, but I feel like from what I very little understand, he was not in the next timeline or in the next part of his life. But no, he is. I don't know. I just think that he would be good in that movie. He seems like he would fit in the world.
Because they're going into the future and he's from the past and being.
So is it going to be the stuff we already know, or is it going to be way in the future?
Or Tenet 2, the rom-com. Give us the gay
love triangle, maybe. with Timothy Chalamet can get into the love triangle.
Oh,
you know?
Man. I would... 5 stars. Just the concept alone, 5 stars. Yeah. Also on Spotify, Joe said Julie Andrews.
Hey, you know what's funny? We also had, I believe, Hunter on Instagram said Julie Andrews, he wants her to be in a Fast and Furious movie.
Okay.
So we've got two Julie Andrews fans
that
listening.
Is so funny. Yeah, I could see her being...
Hey, she goes down like a slide in Princess Diaries 2, yeah. Right? Like, she kind of rocks
down
that slide.
Did you see Aquaman?
No, I didn't.
Okay, apparently she plays the voice of someone in Aquaman. So, like, I guess it's just, like, a cameo. But, you know, maybe, like, is she too old for an action movie now? Like, I think young Julie Andrews could have been an action star. Like...
Yeah, running through the hills of The Sound of Music. She might have been prepping.
I'm
you know,
trying to
get
think
the
of like
in.
Like a plot line of a movie I could see her being in. Maybe like wait. What if we had sorry, this is just so funny in my brain. What about like a Julie Andrews like the pacifier, but like she's the nanny and she's like like a Vin Diesel
remake,
nanny.
Maybe. Yeah,
Pacifier 2, but with Julie Andrews, and she's doing like Kung Fu. Mm.
Yeah. Who's in? Is it Judi Dench? Is in the James Bond movies? Is that her that plays that like the leader?
Yeah.
M,
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
She could have played that role, but maybe like if she was younger, she could have played like a prequel series. Where M is like fighting, actually, you know, and that could have been like her as like an Agent Carter kind of thing, you know, that would have been.
Yeah, I could
pretty,
see
pretty
her
sick.
Doing something like that, like being kind of in an action movie, but not like the star, you know.
Yeah, and she's too like I don't think she'd fit in like a like as funny as the Fast and Furious movie thing is. It like if we're thinking realistically. I don't think that would be the kind of action star she would be.
Yeah, I agree.
But there's a lot of different action movies. So yeah, let's get her in one. We have a lot more here, so we might have to start going a little faster. We have Zach Michaels here with, he said Wallace Shawn. You know, that would be funny.
Yeah, in what kind of, I guess we don't have time to pitch a movie.
Well, you know, like those like buddy comedies with like Kevin Hart, like those kind of things. You'd definitely be in one of those kind of movies. Bryce said Christian Wiig and Bill Hader, and I mean they already have chemistry, so they just got to transfer.
Yeah,
it.
Isn't there some action in Barry though? Like, would he?
Yeah,
already
that's what I was thinking. Like, he already kind
star?
Of is doing some of that. I mean. I think there would be more action in, like, a prequel series of that show. But, yeah, he already is kind of venturing into a different territory. So she's just got to follow in that lead. We have Mike. He said Mark Duplass, which, I mean, what was their last movie? Was the tennis one their last movie?
Oh, Paddleton?
Maybe they're working on one right now.
That
working
would
on
be
a big
funny.
Action movie. Red Notice 2, maybe. They're doing Red Notice 2. That's their new Netflix movie.
Let's see. Jamie from Bloody Broads Pod said, this is so hard. I'm thinking Ethan Hawke and Angela Bassett.
Yeah, I don't know Angela Bassett. I don't know Angela Bassett's career as well. I know Ethan Hawke does a ton of movies. So he's definitely, like, he was in Magnificent Seven.
Yeah, I feel
and
like
he does like
done,
a lot of smaller films like that.
He's done like action adjacent films.
Yeah, like Training Day. He's been like a crooked cop in some movies. Like he's definitely dabbled.
And I think she has too. Like she's been in some like TV shows, like a cop show, one of those, and
one of those.
Right? Like wasn't she in a cop show
yeah,
or something?
No, that I think so.
Okay.
I guess, like, maybe we would think, like, what would be their big breakout, like, if they were wanting to be, like, I'm an action star.
Yeah,
and
right.
This is me. They definitely, neither of them have done that, so maybe we can get Ethan Hawke in Tenet 2. He can be
hire them all for Tenet 2. I could see Angela Bassett being in Tenet 2. I could see her being some kind of like secret agent type, you know, boss person that is like, oh yeah, you come to me, I'm the commander, but like isn't out, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, she's the person that's calling the shots. Like, that's the kind of vibe she gives me.
What else do we have here? We got a couple from Dan.
Yeah, Danny said Kingsley Benadir, baffled why he isn't leading action tent poles by now. And then he also said Rajay John Page. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, but... Oh, he said he hopes he becomes the next James Bond. That would be cool. Oh,
okay. I mean, James Bond is definitely a role at this point where I think it will be really cool if they pick someone like that that isn't... Because Daniel Craig wasn't really like an action star, you know?
Because he's the one that's in that Bridgerton. Netflix show, right? Okay, Bridgerton. I haven't watched that yet, but I've seen a lot about him. And I think that was his breakout, right? So it would be cool to see him kind of like blow up into some of these other type things. He would be a great James Bond.
Yeah, I mean, he already has like kind of like the Titanic thing. Like, he has like a big established fan base like Leo did, you know, and bringing in the crowd for that. I think that'd be a good cast. And I feel like it's been in the news recently. Aren't they like kind of looking for someone right now? Like, that's their next move. They're looking for James Bond right now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he could be auditioning right now. We wouldn't even know.
Well, isn't also Kingsley supposed to be in that Marvel series?
Yeah.
So I don't know what he's doing in that, but I don't know anything about roles. That show, but it'll be interesting to see. Maybe that will be him breaking into the action scene.
Yeah, and he's a really good actor. Like, he was really good in the One Night in Miami. Yeah, he was really good in that.
I haven't seen that yet. I just got the Criterion DVD of it for my library book sale, though.
I think you'd like it. It's pretty good. It's a good movie.
Yeah, I've been meaning to watch it. It just is one that never happened. He played Malcolm X, right?
Yeah, I feel like with that one, everyone kind of thought it was real Oscar bait, so it almost went like over the edge where they were like, oh, this is too much. But I feel like it actually was like, a lot. It wasn't really Oscar bait, really. Like, it is a little bit, but I think there's a lot in there that was like of higher quality than
people just want to call anything like that Oscar bait.
Yeah, like, so you can have, I mean, especially because it's not like a real story either. Like, it's a fictional idea of their, I mean, this is not a podcast about One Night in Miami, but I would recommend people watch
they're
it.
Like, oh my gosh, a movie about race, Oscar bait.
Oscar bait.
A movie with black people, Oscar bait.
Political. And we also have Dan on Twitter here. Another Dan said, Emma Stone, she aces choreography, oozes charm, and expertly conveys vulnerability, which he said he prefers to like cool stoicism. So I guess that's like the opposite of what the James Bond would be that we were just talking about.
Interesting. I wonder if she was she considered for Black Widow at all?
I have no idea.
Or was she too young at that point?
Yeah, well, and it's like, I think I feel like if she was going to be an action star, she probably would have already done it after Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Like, that would have probably been the route she went. So she probably didn't pick that route, you know? Because now she does, I mean, she did Cruella, which is like an IP kind of thing, but that's not really action. So it's like, I don't know if I feel like she might not, but you know, maybe get her in Tenet 2 and we'll see what happens.
I think I could see her being an action star.
Yeah. I feel like she'd be a good villain, actually. I think that'd be fun too.
Wasn't she in what are those movies? Those action movies. The ones with
Fast and Furious?
No,
Mission Impossible.
Woody Harrelson and Jesse Eisenberg. Wasn't she in those?
Oh, Zombieland? Yes, Zombieland. She was in Zombieland.
Does that count as an action movie? So I don't know why I couldn't kind remember
of
zombies.
It's kind of action-y. It's like, it's definitely action comedy. So it's not like a full-on action, but yeah. I think that would be a good showcase, I think, in that movie for sure. Like, to kind of showcase like what she can do maybe in an action movie.
Sure.
Yeah, good call there. You know, I think we have created multiple new career paths for some of our favorite, for Julie Andrews. Well, that was like an alternate career path. Like if she could go back in time. I think she probably chose the correct path though. I don't know.
I 100% agree.
As much as it'd be cool to see her in Fast and Furious. Maybe she can be like the voice of, like, I'm sure the cars in Fast and Furious now, I haven't seen any Fast and Furious movies, but I'm sure the cars now are like maybe the newer cars, like, and maybe she can be a voice assistant in one of the cars, you know, they have like voice assistants, like,
sure.
That'd be pretty fun. And maybe like they hack in, I don't know, that could be a cool, fun role. Get her in there.
I could see it. Well, I think that's kind of what she did in Aquaman. Like she just played the random voice cameo of something. That's what it looked like. I don't know. Never seen it.
Living her best. Just get cash in those checks with those little voice roles. That's all you got to do.
Yeah. Like she needs the checks.
Like she needs the checks. Yeah. It's just like for tea, you know, it's like her tea fund. Like you got to get it in there. And she just puts it in, budgets it.
Her spending money, English breakfast tea.
Oh man.
All right, let's move on.
Yeah, thank you to everyone for answering. Those were some great answers. And we'll have another question at the end of this episode for you all to answer as well. So very exciting. Let's jump though into the episode. So like you said, we covered Bottle Rocket and Rushmore last episode. I'd definitely recommend people check that episode out before, like, because we're definitely just gonna like build on our thoughts, but you can also listen to this separately. Like it will only kind of enhance rather than like you need to listen to the last episode. But I think even though you didn't really like either of the movies, I think we both ranked Rushmore over Bottle Rocket, right? That's like where our rankings were. Okay. So I feel like that's almost everyone would have ranked those two like that. So that's what the rankings are, I guess, going into the watching these next three. So Rushmore was 1998, I think. And so that means Royal Tenenbaums was 3 years later in 2001. So we're still at the point where none of us have seen didn't watch these in the theater, you know, so nothing to talk about there. but
It's going to be a long time until there's a movie that I have seen in the theater, because I think Isle of Dogs was the first one I saw of his in the theater.
Wow, me too. So. Me too. Look at us. Who would have thought? hey, you know, if they re-released them, I'd watch them in the theater. So, you know, that's how it is. We're not really doing a lot of history about these. I have some fun facts, so we can get into some fun facts, but why don't we just read the summary of the movie first, and then we'll kind of go into our thoughts about it and talk about it, like, in relation to the career and everything.
Do you want me to read this one?
Sure. I tried to write these as best as I could.
Okay.
His movies are so hard to write summaries for. I've realized that.
Yeah.
There's so many things going on.
Well, and a lot of them aren't like a surefire plot either. It's kind of just like people existing in a world.
People vibing in New York.
Okay. After a long separation from her husband, Royal, Etheline Tenenbaum realizes she is ready to move on when being proposed to by her accountant, Henry Sherman. However, Royal is not going down without a fight. He hatches a plot to tell Etheline he is dying of stomach cancer and that he wants to mend his relationship with his family before he passes. Due to that and other unrelated circumstances, the Tenenbaum children are also currently living in their old family home, meaning the whole family is living under the same roof for the first time in over 22 years. Will Royal be able to heal the wounds he's inflicted upon his family? Or will everyone's grief consume them until nothing is left?
Wow. So I tried to get the juxtaposition there with like the living under the same roof. So it sounds fun. But then the last sentence is like pretty depressing. So it's pretty much what the movie is, you know?
This movie to me, if I could describe it, feels like Succession, but like brighter. Wow. Like this whole movie, like we've got what? The three kids. Well, sorry, Connor.
Dang, Connor. Connor is Eli. That's who Connor is, really. Even the whole character is basically Eli. So
Yeah.
You're right. I guarantee you they
at least...
As soon
as it came out of my mouth, I was like, oh no,
like this was a, that this had to be an inspiration or something. That's such a good point. And I feel like the character, like, who would, Ben Stiller would be Kendall. And then there would be Luke Wilson would be Roman.
Yeah.
And then there's only one girl, so that has
I'm just thinking since Luke Wilson tried to kill himself and Kendall tried to kill himself.
The only thing is because I feel like Luke Wilson has more of like a shield, like he kind of puts on the front, you know, kind of like Roman. So that's what I was thinking too.
And he is obsessed with his adopted sister and Roman is obsessed with Jerry.
Lots of great parallels to be made. I think there's just a thing to be said about like eccentric white families more than anything.
Rich families that
have too much going on.
It's Royal and Roy, like come on.
Oh man, come on guys, get the crossover, get it going. As far as like just feeling like personal like relationship to the movie, I don't know like what my personal, I think I first watched this, it was like on Hulu and I was on my laptop. Not a great way to watch this for the first time. It was a few years ago, 5 years ago. I don't know. But I remember, I feel like with this movie, I have like one issue with it, one like big issue with it. And like, it's gotten like at the first time I watched it, it was really apparent. And then the more times I've seen it, it's still there, but it's just like not as apparent anymore. Which happens, I think, with a lot of his movies where, like, I think sometimes the things that stick out as weird on first watch sometimes make more sense as it goes on. But I still do think it's an issue, which we'll get into. But what do you have any, like, personal stories about this? I feel like, again, we'll definitely get more of these as it goes, but we just got to ask the question.
Yeah, I don't have any. I watched this, same as I said in the last episode, when I was watching through his filmography. And that's about it. This week was the second time I watched it, so.
Wow, only the second?
I guess my personal, I'll give a personal anecdote.
Okay, personal anecdote
time. So I was in the thrift store, and I was looking through a bin of movies, because there's a Goodwill by us that has, like, these massive bins of movies, and you know you have to, like, pull through everything and sort everything. And at the bottom of one of the bins was a Royal Tenenbaums Criterion. Mm.
Wow.
And I was like, oh my gosh, that's crazy. And then I got it for like a dollar or two. But the outer case was, or maybe it didn't have the outer case. There was something like,
is it the
didn't
DVD,
have the outer,
right?
It is the DVD.
Yeah, right. I know that's the case. Yes.
And then I was at another thrift store and I saw it again. So then I bought it again because it was... Well, I had the outer, I think it, I had the outer sleeve, but the, I don't know, but this one was in better condition. So I, and this one didn't have the booklet. So I took the booklet from the other one and then I switched the sleeve. So it was, I had the nicer condition one. So if anyone wants the Criterion of just sit without the sleeve, I have
it. Yeah, right. And without the booklet. It's just like literally just the DVD, but for free.
Yeah. Yeah, and it has the special features on it.
Yeah, so. I will say it is that is like a one I see a lot in like used Criterion sections. Is the Royal Tenenbaums DVD? I don't know if like they just printed a ton of those, but I do see that one a lot. But that's
well,
a fun
the fact
story.
That I found it in rural Virginia
in Goodwill.
Twice.
Goodwill is pretty crazy.
Twice in rural Virginia.
I was talking more like movie stores like specific. So yeah, Goodwill. I definitely haven't found any of those that stuff is good out of Goodwill. So okay, yeah, so at least in relation to the career, so the Rushmore, we kind of talked about how Bottle Rocket had a like not a lot of this, I mean the style I guess we would associate with him, which I guess would be like very symmetrical and like a lot of different colors in the color palette,
yeah, and movement like
movement exactly. Yeah, and even like some of the needle drops, like so Bottle Rocket I think didn't have a lot of that, and then we were talking about Rushmore, and that one I think it's you it when you look at that one and this one, that Rushmore definitely feels like a stepping stone to get to this movie. I like Rushmore better, but so it's, I'm not saying that as a bad thing, but like, I think that this movie, the style is a lot more clear. I definitely think it's interesting, like, looking at Rushmore than looking at this, and it's like everything that he did in Rushmore, but like just more and crazier.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is basically how it goes until you get to like a certain movie that like is not in this episode. But yeah, I think the it's definitely an interesting one in his career, because it was his biggest hit at the time, because it was a $21 million budget and it made $71.4 million. Can you imagine a movie getting that much of like a profit now? Like this, I mean, now it would with his name, but like if it was not someone that like that
right,
was famous,
right.
I don't know. It wouldn't have even gotten made for that much. And I think one of the reasons is Gene Hackman, because like that was like a big star, where like Bill Murray's a big star, but I don't think like in the same way Gene Hackman was a big like a big pull in 2001, because he was so particular with the roles he accepted. So I think that might have been a big reason why they made that much money. And I think his casting is one of the best parts of the movie, because he's really good. So
yeah, he's great.
What else? What do you like? I mean, we haven't even talked about, like, what do you think about this movie? So you can kind of give your thoughts, I guess.
I like it. I liked it better, like, this second time I watched it.
Mm.
Like, I think I raised it half a star or something.
You did. I saw that, yeah.
I enjoyed it. I think it's just, like, a fun little watch, basically. I mean, like, obviously there's parts of it that are not fun, because
right, I know what you're saying,
are just
though.
Very messed up, but I think that it definitely is, like, it's cool to see in context of his career, because, like you said, I mean, apart from Rushmore, like, Rushmore was almost there in terms of style, but I think this really, like, hammers down what people can expect from him. Because I think after watching Bottle Rocket and Rushmore, it's like, okay, this guy is kind of cool. Like, his work seems interesting. It'll be cool maybe to see what he does next. But then you watch this and it's like, oh, wow, this is awesome. I want to see what this guy does next.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting about it is, like, Rushmore was good. But I think, like, Rushmore, Max is really like the only really distinct character, which is fine, but it's interesting. And then you go to this movie and there's like basically like how distinct Max is, but like multiplied by like at least like 10. There's so many distinct characters in this movie that all have things to do and backstories that play into everything, that it's really like crazy, like going from one to the other, because like this just amps everything up, and like you really get all of those specificities in this one,
sure.
Especially in that opening montage that kind of sets everything up, which is a great montage.
Yeah, it's really good.
He loves like openings. Like, I feel like so many of his movies, Life Aquatic is like this, like they have like five different like intros to the movie until like it gets to like the story.
Yeah.
Which works most of the time. I think in this one it's fun, 'cause like you have the montage, and then they do like the character introductions with their names, and then it's like then you finally get to the story. So it has like the two big intros there, and then it takes a while for them even to get together though into the house.
Yeah.
What'd you think about the sets and like the stuff? Because I think this one really ups the set. They used 250 sets about that.
Wow.
And that's another thing from Rushmore, where like Rushmore is definitely, like, you have the schools and the place where he works, like the what does he do? Engineering, I guess, that place. I don't know.
Yeah.
But Rushmore has so many sets, and like there's like even just for like 5 seconds, there's like a whole set for one thing. So what did you think about that? And like, I guess maybe even how they kind of melded together, and if they maybe felt off, or I don't know.
No, I mean, I wasn't even like thinking about it, you know. Like, because I feel like it works so well that I wasn't even thinking, like, oh my gosh, they're in another room, they're in another room, they're in another place, they're in another building. Like, everything is so stylized that it doesn't take you out of it when it changes where the sets are. Because if, like, you're going to be stylized when you're outside on the street the same way you're stylized when you're focusing on a bathtub, like, it's going to look cohesive either way. Whereas, like, another movie, if there isn't such a specific, like, idea of set design and theme throughout between, that everything is going to have a specific aesthetic, that it might not be that way. Like, if you're at a billion different set pieces. But with this, I think it works.
Yeah, I agree. I think until this point, he had created worlds around the characters. So maybe, like, it felt like the characters lived in a world that they've created. Like, they just, like, are quirky people. But I think this is the first movie where it felt like he created his own, like, entire world that everyone, like, in the world lives in. So, like, it's this weird version of New York where everything kind of feels a little different and a little off, rather than it just being like, if it's just Rushmore, it feels like, oh, it might just be like this one little area that's like this. But this really feels like a big expansive place, and they go everywhere. Yeah. They go to the YMCA. You have everyone at their different houses in the beginning. I mean, Richie, like, is at a tennis match, and so, like, you have the big tennis match. And so, like, everything feels really interconnected in that way, especially, like you were saying, with all the different rooms in the house itself, which was a real house. Everything except the kitchen scenes were filmed in that house, and they, like, made that house the way it is. Actually, cool. What's funny, the owner, like, had just bought the house and was planning on remodeling it, but then he agreed to let them film there for the price he bought the house for. So he just got the house for free. And now, wow. I mean, I'm assuming he sold it for a ton of money. Like, the Tenenbaum house had probably sold for a lot of money. So that guy really made out pretty well, I think. But yeah, just, like, the way that each room is constructed, and you feel the geometry of the entire house. One thing that I thought was one of the coolest sets, it's really small, but when they go into the game room with all the board games, which is, that's another, like, one of his little, like, specificities, which is funny because so many people, like, have a closet for board games, but they just don't, like, talk about it. But, like, you see it, you're like, oh yeah, the board game closet. But the way they shot that, where, like, it's such a small space, and, like, they had to, like, I don't like how they got the camera in there. And then they reverse shot it where you're looking basically from, like, if you were a board game, because you're, like, looking from the other side. So it's like little things like that where, like, you know, that took so long to set up that way to make it look like they were in the same room, but you're, like, on the shelf now. And there's so many things like that where I think this is the first movie where you really see, like, how he uses space. And, like you said, how he moves the camera in the space, which I think, I mean, as far as the themes, like, what would you say, like, the themes of the movie you think are, like, what's it, what are kind of, like, the ideas?
I mean, definitely, like, family is
gotta
probably.
Gotta love family.
He loves those, like, ensemble, family, broken people try to still love each other despite their flaws. Grief, I would say. Anxiety. Yeah,
grief is huge, because, like, so many, I feel like a lot of his movies have, like, some death that's, like, either just happened, or, like, they're kind of talking, like, everyone is kind of talking about, or in this case, yeah, it's, I like, mean, the divorce.
All three of these movies have a death in it, basically, or, like, something that revolves around death in it.
Yeah, well, yeah, all three of the ones we're talking about today, for sure.
Yeah,
and it's
all,
like,
three of the ones we're talking about today.
And it's not ever a death where it's like, it happens in the movie. It's always like the characters reacting to either a death or, like, a big event, like the divorce in this one.
Well, there's a death in Darjeeling that happens.
No, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, so there's, like, a death beforehand, and then we watch, like, what happens afterwards, you know, and, like, how they react to it and how it changes their lives. Well, because Darjeeling Limit is about the father's death, right?
Oh, I was talking about the kid that dies in it.
Oh, no, I was saying, like, because this is about, like, their divorce, you know, I think, is, like, the event that this is about. And then Life Aquatic is about his partner's death. I mean, that's, like, the event that they're ruminating over. And then, so, like, I know there's deaths in them after, in the movie itself, but I also was saying, like, they're even about death before the movie even starts, because, like, that's the, what this story is built on, is, like, either death or tragedy or grief or something. And then the characters are like kind of having to deal with all of that in their different ways. Cause I like how Ben Stiller, like how, I mean, he has his wife's death actually. So that's a death there. And how he reacts to, he's like just such a control freak basically. And like, you get to see how everyone reacts to like all of these tragedies that have happened in their lives and what they have to do to get past it, I guess, or like make peace with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't really have anything else to say about this one.
Do you have any like flaws, I guess? Because I have at least one flaw. I mean, there's like little nitpicks you can make, but
I'll think. You say yours.
Okay. Yeah. My main flaw that I was saying, like the first time I watched it, really stood out, and then as I went, it definitely. Once you know the structure of his movie, because they always move so fast too, like it feels more in the flow of the film. But the first time it's like, I still think Royal's quote unquote transformation, I guess, or like his character development happens very quickly. And there's not really like, I kind of looked for it this time too. There's not really like quite a reason for it, which you don't ever like, you don't need like, oh, this big moment happens and it changed my life, you know? But I think at least for how drastic of a character shift his is, you might have needed like some specific moment. I guess you could probably say it was one, getting kicked out of the house, and then Richie is his attempted suicide was like the event. But I still feel like there's not like it just feels a little unearned at that turning point to me sometimes.
Yeah, because it was like basically him just being like, oh yeah, you're not allowed in the hospital, and then like that's it, and he didn't even react like super strongly to that, and then all of a sudden he's like, oh yeah, I'm gonna be happy and do all these things with my grandkids, and now I will work a peasant's job, and I will work in the lobby in the elevator, and like it just felt like, you know, like things that he had looked down upon, being a rich person, like he's doing those things now. And I just don't think that if you're like an old white racist rich person man, like that you can just make that switch right away.
Yeah, I think like with the grandkids, I mean, he definitely in the beginning of the movie, the beginning of like when the story starts, not like when he's like getting divorced, he like has the desire to be in his family's lives, you know, so I think he already has like that desire to want to like help them. But I feel like he can't let his ego, like his ego keeps getting in the way of that, you know. And he like, but then like I just don't understand what switched to make him like want to get the divorce and then like do all the, I, you know what I'm saying, like it just felt like,
yeah,
I don't know when that happened, because I feel like I make sense why he wanted to help like be with his grandchildren and stuff at the end, like he already wanted that, but I just don't know when he stopped being as self-centered as he was in the first half of the movie.
Yeah,
you know, maybe it is just working that minimum wage job. It does a lot for you working. he was very humbled. We missed out on the short film of him working at the hotel with all all those rich people at the hotel. That could have been, you know, they could have had something there.
I mean, my, like, minimum wage jobs make me hate life more than be happy. Like,
yeah, that's true. But he has friend with him. You know, they're vibing. But that would have been funny. Maybe like if they had one scene of, or a couple like of him like his interacting with other guests that maybe he saw himself in, and that makes him like be like, wow,
sure,
they are the worst. And then he's like, yeah, just something like that where
Scrooge moment.
Yeah, like a Scrooge moment. You gotta have a Scrooge moment. But other than that, like, I do think this is a really just a fun movie, like you said. And it's hard, weird to say fun, because it's very dark at some parts. But
well, that's how all his movies are. Like,
yeah, you're right.
At least these, especially in this phase of his career, like Rushmore, even Bottle Rocket a little bit, but I think not as much. But like this one and Aquatic and Darjeeling specifically feel very like happy on the outside, but as soon as you start thinking about it, it's like, ooh, yikes, this is a bit dark.
Well, I think too, it's like the way the dialogue is written, like it's so it is like very funny, but then like what they're saying is, when you just like take what they're saying at its face value, like it's obviously like very serious, you know, like what they're talking mm-hmm. about. But they both like deliver the dialogue, write the dialogue in the way, and also just like everything looks so fun or like so engaging. And so it kind of like tricks you into getting like really like excited, and then like you start thinking about it, and it's like, oh man, this is
well, that's like sad. I sent you that bus meme, like with the yeah. guy looking out at the sunny, and then the guy like sad, like that is the perfect description.
Yeah, of, like, watching Wes Anderson without audio is like looking out at the sunny, and then watching it with audio, listening to the story is
yeah
looking out cloudy. Or maybe just reading the screenplay would be like the cloudy, like, Dan, this is rough. It's, yeah, it'd be interesting to like see this directed by someone else, and like how, because I think if this is directed the way that the story is very dark. So I think if this was directed darker, it wouldn't work as well, because I just think the biggest reason you like it is because the characters are so vivid and interesting, and they are able to endear you to them in like so quickly, you know. Which I think, like, whenever you have kids that are got parents there got divorced, and they show like how terribly they were treated as kids, like you're instantly going to have some connection. So I think that, again, the montage is a very good way of just like establishing mm-hmm. you care about them. And yeah, I think I don't have much more to say about this one. I do think it's like a big moment in his career, though, because it's like I said, a big box office success, had a lot of press. Like Bottle Rocket, like we said, was a failure financially, and Rushmore was more just like a art house kind of hit, more like it was just not art house, but it was just smaller, obviously. But this is the one where yeah. like you said, people, I think if you're gonna say Wes Anderson, this is one of like the two or three they'll say, which is impressive yeah. for like your third movie, like in a 21
I think this
years
is
later.
Where his career switch happened, where it went from a movie by Wes Anderson to a Wes Anderson film.
Very, very good.
And
very
in
good
the title,
quote there.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's not just Royal Tenenbaums by this dude, Wes Anderson. It's like a Wes Anderson film, the Royal yeah. Tenenbaums. Like, just very specific, like, from here on out, like, a distinct, this is a Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah, and I think we'll see maybe how that plays into the next two movies we're going to talk about in a second, which are like, they were maybe seen more under that light, where Tenenbaums was maybe more just like, oh yeah, I watched that one movie or those two movies, and then it's like, oh wow, this is what he's like as a director. And then these next two ones we'll talk about, like, you go into the movie with that expectation, which is now, I guess, what you do with all of his movies. But yeah, let's take a quick ad break, and then we'll start, come back, we'll talk about The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. Wow, here to talk about The Life Aquatic with Jacques Cousteau. Whoops, I mean Steve Zissou. My bad. yeah, this one is really interesting to talk about. I'm excited. I mean, I know we both like it, but I think it's also interesting just to talk about with, like, career-wise as well. Because there's a lot of stuff that happened, I think, in the aftermath that kind of affected a lot of stuff. But
sure,
let's quick read. I can read the summary here, and then we'll get into just our thoughts on it. Steve Zissou is an aging oceanographer who has gained a substantial following throughout his career by creating documentaries of his travels and discoveries. His latest documentary, which ended with the tragic death of his friend Estevan by a so-called jaguar shark, was not well received, meaning funding a sequel where Steve hunts down the beast will be difficult. However, at the festival where the film is being screened, Steve is approached by Ned, an airline pilot who claims to be Steve's illegitimate son. When Ned agrees to drop his job and help fund the next part of the documentary, the whole Zissou crew sets off on a hunt to slay the jaguar shark, filming every step of the way. Or every wave of the way. Every row of the way. They don't row the boat, but, you know, the pun still works.
Yeah, what is it, like, every knot or whatever?
Every knot of the way. Every breeze of the way. Doesn't have the right ring to it. Man. So personal anecdotes, just talking about our, like, maybe our relationship to the movie. I think this feels like the movie where, like, you, at least now, where if you watch this movie, it's because you are watching it for his career. Like, you like him as a director. I don't think this is ever the one where there's, like, people that are like, oh, I liked that one, maybe we'll throw on another one. Even just, like, I mean, it's his longest movie. It's almost 2 hours long. And I just think it feels like it's turned into the one where, like, this is the one for, like, this is the one for the Wes Anderson stands out there. Like, that's what this one feels like to me. And I think that's what I went into it thinking. I thought it was going to be, I think, the first time I watched it, I feel like I thought it was going to be, I wasn't going to like it as much. But like I said, I think if you like him and you like his movies and are really into his whole career, this is like one of the top ones for you.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel like about this one?
Yeah, I really like this one. Let's see, a personal anecdote. I watched it the summer that I watched all of Wes's filmography.
Oh, man.
That's going to be literally every movie, almost every movie on this list. I like this one probably a lot more than some other people too. Like, I would say it's more in, like, my middle ranking. Like, I have ones that I like more and ones that I like less.
Yeah.
But it's definitely up there for me. Just, like, the vibe, the aesthetic,
the ocean. There's so much to love.
Marine biology. It's very fun. But also not fun. But also,
it's definitely one of his, like, most depressing movies.
It is.
I think for sure. I think it's interesting because one of the things with his career, with the early part of his career, so you have Bottle Rocket, Rushmore, Round of Tenenbaums, and now this one, where they all revolve around, like, a controlling, and it will be the next movie too, and even Fantastic Mr. Fox, they all revolve around a controlling, like, central male character, who has to, like, learn to not be as controlling or accept his life more, or, like, learn how to appreciate life more, or, like, just learn something, and then by the end they're, like, a nicer version of themselves.
Sounds very Noah Baumbach.
Yeah, I mean, definitely Noah Baumbach in this one, and you can really feel the
more one of his depressing main edge things he does in his movies, which is one reason why I don't like him, is redeeming male characters that are grubby people. But I feel like in this, it works better. Like, but it is very similar to, like, you can tell that he was a co-writer on this because it's a theme that he does a lot, like, in his own work as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think, like I said, it is the same in Bottle Rocket, Rushmore, and Tenenbaums, so leading up to this movie. But I do think you can tell his writing there too, because I think this has the best of the four character progression of the main character, because I think you really feel his growth in this movie as it goes. And I think then, like, you have the scene at the end in the submarine, then I have at the film festival, and it just feels a lot more earned, I think, in this. So even though I think I like Tenenbaums more just because there's just more fun things in Tenenbaums. I don't know. There's, like, more things I just like. I'm so excited to see in Tenenbaums. But I do think, like, with my critique of Tenenbaums, this one kind of fixes that, I guess. Or it does that a lot better. I think it's, like, one of his best central character progressions through a movie.
Yeah.
Which might be why some people don't like it as much, because it's very central character focused instead of, like, all, like, the crazy eccentric characters, even though there is a big ensemble. Like, it really does feel like Bill Murray's movie.
Yeah, I would agree.
So what can we talk about here? I think it's interesting now. I mean, we both watched that Cousteau documentary, right? The Disney Plus one.
Yeah. Oh, loved and I think that one.
After watching that and, like, learning more about him, it's really interesting seeing the parallels of this, even with Cousteau's son.
Sure.
And, like, that whole thing. Like, it's really crazy how much inspiration they took from that.
Yeah, I mean, they dressed all the characters to look just like Cousteau, which I knew, but, like, watching that and the way that they filmed and stuff.
Yeah.
And obviously, like, Cousteau is, like, actually a extremely talented filmmaker and environmentalist and marine biologist. Mm-hmm. So, like, he's clearly had a little bit more going for him than Steve here.
But... yeah, Steve is just making some docs. I think he was just out there vibing.
He's just out there vibing. But it is it is interesting to see, like, the inspiration without it being, like, a biopic. Like... which is kind of a different approach for sure. Like, you take someone or a caricature of someone, basically, where, like, this idea of a person who's very unique and specific and aesthetic goes out on a boat and makes movies. Like, I can understand why that is very appealing to Wes Anderson.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And why he probably liked Cousteau and wanted to make a story. But, like, I don't know. It's... obviously, Wes Anderson doesn't really seem like a biopic type guy. So it's interesting to take his own spin on, like, a real-life person to, like, make it, I don't know, different.
Yeah, I feel like that's definitely a lot of his movies, even though if they're, like, not, like, a famous person, sure. So we might not know. But he definitely, like, takes a lot from real life. And so I think it's just interesting because I know who Cousteau is to, like, see how much he actually...
yeah.
Took from that and then, like, put on this. There's a lot to here, I think, that really paved a different path for him, at least as far as just the movie itself goes. So it's the first one that he filmed outside America. And he filmed this after he went to Europe, and then he filmed it in Europe, which I think, like, now Europe, I feel like, is just so... I mean, he was always inspired by, like, French New Wave and stuff, but I feel like after this one, you can really feel all of, like, the Europeanness in his movies. Like,
sure.
I think, like, you, because now he's, like, even how the way he dresses, like, it's just funny. Because I know you watched one of the documentaries. Did you watch the one where, like, he was riding on his bike? Like,
I watched.
Off of set. Like, because he just looks so funny, like, in his little tuxedo, like, riding on his bike through the streets.
He's so funny. He's a funny guy.
Yeah, so I think that's big, which I, like, just thought of, where this is the first one set in Europe and, like, other countries, and then he kind of does that more as it goes on. Like, so few of his movies, like, not so few of his, but a lot of his movies, like, later now are not set in America, or, like, a lot of parts of them
it
are not
definitely
set in America, you know?
Fits the style more. I think it is, like, New York is kind of the exception, which obviously with Tenenbaums it worked, but I think with stuff like Bottle Rocket, like, you could get the aesthetic that he's going for out of America.
In Texas.
But, like, it doesn't work as well. Like, when you think about that aesthetic, yeah. And you're like, oh, like, it feels very European and not Texas. Like, yeah. It feels more pretentious of an aesthetic than, like, something you would get in America because it's so stylized. Because America just doesn't have culture. We don't have style.
Rip.
And that's, like I said, kind of New York. And I, you know, but I think this specific, like, highbrow refinery smoking a cigarette look that he is going for is European.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think, though, like, the like, what he found in this movie too was that Europeanness, like you said, is really crucial to his style, but also, like, then you see the American influence on the Europe, like, so, like, the European is the base, and then, like, the American influence is, like, reaches through that. So you even have characters like Ned in this movie, who's, like, from Kentucky, and he talks, like, in this Kentucky accent, and it's, like, it's the juxtaposition, I think, is what it makes his style,
which I think is really just him in general. Like, it's just his personality.
Like,
him
in Europe. That's how I imagine him in Europe. Yeah. Like, just being like that. Yeah. The accent is so funny too. That's, like, one of the funniest accents in a movie. Owen Wilson's in this one.
Yeah. Owen Wilson is a great character actor.
Yeah. And it's interesting too in this movie, because I think this is one of his best roles. I mean, he doesn't have as many big roles in Wes Anderson movies after this, but I do think this is one of his best in a Wes Anderson movie, maybe his best, because, like, he just has the most to do, and he's the most interesting, and it's the first one, though, that he didn't co-write. Because then I don't think he's co-written after this, but I think it's insignificant in the moment that this is the first movie he didn't write. So maybe that has a part to do with it too, where like he's not writing his characters, he's just like playing them, and that obviously is a lot different of an experience. So I really do like his performance in this, and he has to do a lot of like stuff with Bill Murray doing amazing like acting. So it's like,
yeah,
it's a lot of pressure. But there, I mean, acting in general, though, in this movie, I think is maybe the strongest part, even though there's great stylized stuff. I think the cast is just so well done, even if it's just like a small role. They're
yeah,
all,
like, I mean,
really
like Willem Dafoe and Jeff Goldblum, like
Willem Dafoe has the best side character. He makes the most of that role than like anyone else would.
I mean, he's great. Like both of them, though, like they have, I mean, that's not even a very big role, like either of them.
Yeah.
Like, but because they're present across the movie and they're such good, like, very specific character actors that are very like present in every scene they do. Like when they're in a scene, they basically steal the scene because of how much charisma both of them have. I think that's what kind of makes Wes's movies in general, is just his ability to like get very, very good performances out of ensemble characters.
Yeah, that's a great point. And like make them memorable, even if they're in like one or two scenes. Like there's like maybe a character who has one line, but then that's like you remember that line forever just because it's like so funny, or the way that it was shot was fun. Like it just, everything is memorable, I guess. Even he makes it memorable, even if it's someone that's like not the main character.
Yeah, I agree. And like makes rewatches more fun, because like once you have the plot too, you're able to kind of catch a lot of the like intentionality of the different side things that are going on, because that happens a lot with his movies where you watch it and you really engage with the plot, and then you think, man, I need to rewatch it so I can experience all these other aspects of the work, whether it's the set design or the cinematography or the side characters, any of those different things.
Yeah, and I mean, you have the set, the boat set, which is like
very
cool. One of the craziest sets. Like it was 140 feet long and 40 feet high.
Wow.
That boat set, which is pretty cool. Like,
yeah, it's very impressive.
And they're not like shy. It's so funny because it's like, it's obvious, like they're so proud of it too. And so like this, like they show it, it's like, this is a set, but it's so cool, right? Like they don't even try to hide that it's a set, which I think is cool, because it's like so much of his style is, I think, or his movies try to make you forget that things are sets. But I think in this one, it's like one of the times where it's just cool. It's cooler to know that it's a set, you know, than to think, oh, maybe they just kind of did this in post and they put these rooms together. Because they have the one where he introduces the boat, but then they also do it again where they're walking through the rooms and they're having the conversation, and that's just fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good movie.
It is. It is. And it's interesting because, like, the center of it is a filmmaker looking back on his career and wondering, like, if he has anything left in him, which is funny because, like, he's still at the beginning of his career here. But it's just interesting to think about, like, his projection there. And then you even think that this movie did not do well. This is still his biggest budget for a movie, $50 million. He's never gotten a bigger budget than this after. And I think that part of that, too, is, like, he learned how to consolidate or, like, be better with money, you know? Because, like, his later movies feel bigger than this. But he probably just learned better how to, like, not spend as much, do more with little. Yeah, and it made only 34, so he had a decent loss there. So it's, like, almost like him after this movie is maybe what Steve was at the beginning of the movie. It's just funny to think about.
But I think it is something that a lot of, like, not that there's no... true artists, like, I don't know, I feel like someone who dedicates their whole life to art would be considered a true artist, whether or not you are 100% successful in that. I don't think anyone really is. But, like, that is something that a lot of artists, I think about, is, will I be able to create something beyond this, or will this next project I do be the last project I do? Kind of that starving artist mentality where you think, will I be able to create art forever, or will this be the one that is my downfall? You know, he's probably thinking, will this be the movie that ends my career? And obviously not, because he's a nepotism white man in Hollywood. So he's not at, which we talked a little bit about in our previous episode, which is why I say that. Like, it's not very likely that something like that would end his career by any means.
Mm-hmm.
But it is something that, like, artists think about often, I think. Especially if they're a deep thinker, which I think he is a deep thinker and feeler. So I imagine that he thinks that, at least when he was making this, or projected some, like you said.
And it might even go beyond money, too. Like, will people even, like, enjoy, like... Yeah. Or am I even making anything good anymore, you know?
Sure.
I think that's what Steve is thinking, too. And it's interesting, as the movie goes on, he gets less concerned with the documentary, even. Because, like, at the beginning, he's, like, everything that happens, he's like, did you film that? Are you filming that? And then, like, as it goes, like, he doesn't film... I think at the funeral, the first funeral for the pirate that died, they're filming that. But then for Ned's funeral, they're not filming that. So I think that's, like, an interesting, like... As he goes on, he
kind of feels
realizes,
like a YouTube vlogger, like Jake Paul.
Yes. Steve, the original vlogger. Yeah,
like setting something up and being like, did you get that? Why weren't you running the camera? You always have to be running the camera. Like,
I love when he's with the son. He's like, and they didn't film it. And he's like, that was the most emotional thing that's ever happened on this boat. he's so funny. We didn't do this last time, so we'll have to, like, do both, because we wanted to talk about our favorite needle drops for each movie. So, kind of rewind,
shoot,
Royal Tenenbaums.
Yeah.
This movie, Royal Tenenbaums, has a lot of needle drops, but which one, like, sticks out to you, I guess?
Sorry, let me look and see. That was the one I watched, like, the earliest out of these three, so it's not the one that's most recent in my mind. I even thought of it when I was watching it, and then now I'm not remembering which one it was. Like, I'm looking at the tracks, and I'm still not remembering which.
Well, what was... Do you remember the scene, maybe?
I don't.
Damn. Well, mine is... So, like, I have so many, like, that I really love. I mean, the Hey Jude one is cool. I think it's cool that they don't use the real Hey Jude. I like that. I like the Rolling Stones ones, because, like... He goes into the tent, and then she's playing the record. But there's so many that I like. But my favorite is These Days, the Nico.
Yeah, that, I like that one.
I love that song, and that's like the most famous one too. I think at this point, like, that's just such a famous scene. So I love that one, and then a shout out as well. I mean, Needle in the Hay. Man, there's so many good ones. But I also like the Look at Me, the John Lennon one, because I just love that song. And it feels like that song just, like, really encapsulates Ben Stiller's character. Like, just, like, the feeling of that song.
Sure.
In that movie. So, that would be mine for Tenenbaums, would be These Days, if I had to pick one.
Yeah, I like that one a lot, too. And I like the Beatles stuff at the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. And then now, moving fast forward to The Life Aquatic. This one's weird because just a lot of Dave Bowie, but it's cool that they have, like, the Dave Bowie arrangements and stuff. But what's your favorite from this one? Because there are a few that aren't Dave Bowie as well.
I like the one when he's shooting the pirates, the Stooges song.
Oh, yeah. That's a cool scene. That's, like, he doesn't do a lot of action scenes, but that's a fun one. And I like how he changes the colors, like, when he opens his eyes. The color grading changes, and that kicks in. It's just a fun scene, too. And I think that, yeah, that's a good one. The best needle drop is, in my opinion, is the Queen Bitch needle drop at the end, because that's just an awesome song, and it's a perfect pick for the movie. But this is the fourth and not the last time that he ends a movie with a needle drop and a slow motion shot of the characters walking. So it's like, I feel like I need to go with something else. So I think The Way I Feel Inside, the Zombies song, is a really good choice for Ned's funeral.
Yeah.
Because it's just such a great song, and you just have, like, the solo vocals and then the organ. It's just, like, a great, perfect choice for that movie, in that moment, I guess. So, yeah, that would be mine, I would think. I think it's just, like, a really
good choice. Bowie stuff in it.
Yeah, and I think it's a nice touch about, like, the guy on the boat, too. And, like, they release that album's on Spotify.
Yeah.
I listen to it sometimes.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah, it definitely helps, like, when you're using so many soundtrack songs to, like, do something like that and incorporate that in it.
Yeah, for sure. Because I think if they were all David Bowie, like, there's only a three, I think, that are actual his. But you can still feel him in the movie because, like, the melodies are there, but it just sounds, like, different, which I think works well. All right. I think that's all I pretty much have to say about Life Aquatic for right now.
Yeah, me too.
What 10 out of 10 would love to live on that boat, I guess, is my last thought. All right, so going on to their final movie we're talking about today, which is the Darjeeling Limited. Again, 3 years. He likes to do the 3 year gap. I'm noticing 3 year gap is a big one for him. This is 2007 movie, and just to say up front with the budget thing, so the last budget was $50 million, and this one was only $17.5 million.
Wow.
Which is definitely a response, but it's interesting because I feel like I don't feel the budget dip in this one. So like I said, I think he definitely learns how to work with less, but make it look good. And it's also funny because there's 6 production companies on this movie as opposed to 2 for the last 2. So it's like obviously like needed a little bit of funding there too, just to kind of get it off the ground. One to mention too, before we get into the Darjeeling Limited thing, I don't know how to pronounce this. The Hotel Chevalier. I can't pronounce that name. But the short that goes with the movie. We're not really going to talk about this. I could maybe talk a little bit about it, but it's not really like that. It's cool to talk about it with it, but I don't think it's essential. So we don't really have to talk about it. But it is interesting to note. So it was made a year prior to the movie, and it was supposed to just be a standalone thing with Natalie Portman and Jason Schwartzman, like just like a little 13-minute short. And then they started writing Darjeeling, and they realized that Jason Schwartzman's character was like the same character that they were in that he was in the short. So they were just like, why don't we just make him the same character, you know? And the only thing they had to change was, so you have, you know how the perfume is in her suitcase in the movie, in his suitcase. So they just had to make an insert shot of her putting the perfume in the suitcase, but basically it's just the same short.
Clever.
Yeah, and it premiered at the Venice Film. This is so weird the way they did it, though, because so it premiered with the movie at the Venice Film Festival, and then it released exclusively on iTunes for free a few weeks later. Then in a month, it was removed from iTunes, and then it started to be shown in theaters as a prologue. So, like, it wasn't shown with the movie when it opened, but then after it was off iTunes, then they showed it with the movie.
Huh.
They were, I don't know what, it was a very weird idea. But it is funny, because a lot of critics loved it and said it was like way better than the movie, which is just funny. Like you make the short that's like not even connected, and you just like, oh, here's a short. And then they're like, yeah, this is way better than the movie, which I don't know if I agree with.
That's
like,
funny.
I don't love the movie, but I also don't think like the short is like necessarily way better.
Yeah, I haven't seen the short, so I have no comment.
It's nice. It's basically Jason Schwartzman's Jack in the hotel room with Natalie Portman, and they have sex and then it's over, basically, is the short.
Wow.
There's a lot more that happens, but it's funny though, because like, you know that song, he plays it one time in the movie. There's a song, I forget what it's called, but he plays that in the short, so it's kind of fun. Like, it gives you a little bit of like the connective tissue when you watch the movie. And the short story he writes at the end, that he's like, I wrote the ending but not the beginning, that's the short story that is the movie. So like, it is connected, but you don't really have to like necessarily watch it to understand the movie. Obviously, because you didn't watch it, and I'm assuming you understood the movie, basically. Yeah. What happens? imagine you're like, no, I have no idea what happened. I don't know who these people are. Do you want to read the summary quick, and then we can talk about this one?
1 year after the death of their father, Francis Whitman plans a trip to India for him and his two brothers, Peter and Jack, on which he hopes the three of them can find some sort of spiritual enlightenment. Unbeknownst to his brothers, Francis also has tracked down their mother in India and has plans to confront her about where she's been and why she didn't show up to their father's funeral. However, familial tensions soon start to brew, and the brothers are forced to make a choice between holding on to their past or embracing their future.
Wow.
Dramatic.
Pretty dramatic, you know, as most of his movies are. I think this is his shortest movie. It's 91 minutes.
It feels so long, though.
It does feel pretty long.
What's so interesting to me about this is that when I hear this plot, I imagine it as something that I would love. Like, when I hear just the plot alone, I'm like, wow, this sounds, like, really good. And then I watch the movie, and I feel like I just don't get that from the movie. Like, I just feel like it's not as good as just the idea of the plot. You know what I mean?
The idea of the plot is definitely better.
The execution is not great, but the plot itself, good.
Mm. Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons for that, too, we can talk about. I agree. I think, I'm pretty sure this is my least favorite Wes Anderson movie. I mean, we have to rewatch the others, but I know that I like the others better. This and Bottle Rocket would kind of flip, but I do think, when I think about Bottle Rocket, I, think it's, a lot cool. It's just a lot cooler of an idea for his career, I guess, at least in general. In this movie, I feel like covers a lot of the same themes other movies that he made cover, but just other movies do it better, and they are, and they still have the aesthetic stuff. So I think I like Bottle Rocket a little bit more, just because it feels cooler in the aspect of his career. But yeah, this was the last one I actually watched when I had to watch his filmography. Hmm. This is the last one.
Interesting.
I don't know why. I feel like it just is known as not one of his best ones, because I think Bottle Rocket isn't really talked about at all. And then this is of the quote unquote Wes Anderson stamped movies, this is the worst one people think, which I would agree. I think it definitely doesn't come, like you said, it just doesn't come together, I think, in the way that you would hope it comes together at the end or in the final product.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that parts of it I do really like. And there's some sequences in it that when I was rewatching it, I was like, oh man, maybe this movie is better than I thought it was. And then I would get to another scene and I would be like, oh, but I don't like this. And it just was a constant cycle with this movie of liking things and not liking things. Mm. One scene that I really like is when they are in the temple. And they're kind of praying, I guess, in the temple or doing a spiritual.
The Temple of a Thousand Bulls, that one.
Yeah,
I think the poster shot, right? That one where they're three lined up.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah,
and
where they're
kneeling. Yeah, I know
where they're kneeling
about.
In the temple, and then Adrian Brody gets up and it feels like a very great amalgamation of their characters all together, of their personalities, more of them being kind of frustrated, and then Adrian being like, I need to get up and have some space.
Yeah,
and
I'm gonna
I can't
go pray
be
at another
around
place.
You. I'm gonna pray here. And Owen Wilson's character, I don't even remember which name is which person's which, but he's trying to sort of bring them together and have them be whatever. And it just is very, that scene to me feels more like a Wes Anderson scene to me. Just the kind of peaceful in the moment, letting the characters work within the space. But then I think some of the other scenes, even right after that, when they leave and he's like, oh, let's get our shoes shined. I feel like it takes you out of what the movie just had. That just to me, throughout this whole movie, there's so many ups and downs of kind of being there and thinking, wow, this moment is really good. The characters are really good here. This feels like a Wes story, to it going to something else where it's not as, I guess, interesting or doesn't feel paced well.
Yeah. Yeah. I basically agree. I think it's a little different because I do really actually like everything basically. Until they get off the train.
Sure.
That's really where it cuts for me. And it's really weird because it's halfway through the movie. And I feel like so much of the movie is when they talk about it, they talk about how they made this train and it's a working set. And then they just leave the train. And I understand, I guess, for the story why it happens. But I feel like they could have done something else where they are always on the train. Because it just feels really oh, the train's just out of the picture now. Even though that's the name of the movie. And it never shows up again, really.
Yeah, and it gets very confusing after that. Once they kind of get into where they're in the village and the boy dies and then there's the mother. It just feels like there's so much happening that has nothing to do with the movie itself. Mm-hmm. Or just the way that it's shot and constructed, that's just the way it feels. And I think if maybe when they're on the train, these things kind of happen, you know, and then they keep getting back on the train, that would be helpful to have a cohesive sort of through line tracking through the movie.
Tracking. Keeping it on the rails.
Yeah. I agree. Like, everything before they get off the train, I tend to like a lot more in this movie, or feel more connected to it or engaged with it. And then I think once they get off the train, I get a little bit confused about the timeline and what's happening. Like, it just kind of throws me off a little bit.
Yeah. And I think we were talking about, like, how he works great with ensembles. And I think there's, like, some great characters on the train that all get abandoned, too, after they leave the train. Yeah. You know? And then it's just them three.
Uh-huh.
So it's, like, you lose a lot of that, too, where you... a lot of that specificity and those like cool little details. And the train is so cool too.
I love trains. I love a good movie on a train. I was thinking that when they had the shots of him with Jason Schwartzman with his head out the window, and then the girl looking smoking. With her head out the window, I was like, God, trains are so cool. And then I was thinking about movies on trains and how much I love movies that are on trains. And then how annoyed I was that Murder on the Orient Express I thought was a terrible movie. And how I wish that would have been a movie. Like, I wish Wes Anderson could make Murder on the Orient Express. Like, that was what
that
I was thinking.
That would be a great, that would be a pretty great thing. Yeah,
I just feel like trains are built for this aesthetic. Like, I love trains. I just wish this whole movie I'd been on the train because I love trains so much.
Yeah, and I mean, it's so hard because like when I talk about this movie or like think about it in certain ways, I really do love it. But like you said, like just watching it and like, this is not my favorite experience to watch this, at least the second half. But I do think it's like really, for a lot of reasons, a really like big like line with his career after this movie. And you can see him kind of like interrogating his own like movies, I guess, in this, because it's all about like these people that are trying to control their own environment. I think the train is basically like a microcosm of the world. I mean, they show it too when they go like through all the people, like Bill Murray, Natalie Portman, like in the train. And so like that's like them trying to control stuff and like stay in their own little world, I guess, and like with their father dying and everything. And then once they get off the train, that's like the randomness of everything and then more embracing life and learning how to live outside of that little bubble that they create. And I think, I mean, even though it's, I think, a not good part of the movie, like the messiness, I guess, kind of is that because like it's so unstructured that it kind of goes with the theme of like just letting life happen. And then like you have the tiger that is like death lording over everything. Yeah. So there's a lot of like interesting ideas going on. And maybe you can even say like this is him being like figuring out how to leave behind maybe his like perfectionism or like having to have all of those details that we talk about, because it was filmed in India and like they didn't really have extras. They kind of just filmed in the streets a lot of the time. And so like you can see that like juxtaposition of like the train is so perfect, but then they go off the train and it's like feels so out of character and everything is all over the place. So it's like I said, like really interesting to talk about, but maybe just like in practice, like I don't really like watching it as much. Maybe I'll watch a couple scenes, like the dinner scene, or the first dinner scene is so funny when he like orders for them and he's like, he likes to order for himself. He takes out his tooth. The characters are good. It's just like maybe the way that the structure of the movie is paced, it just like loses me for sure as it goes.
Yeah.
And I do think, as we'll see with Fantastic Mr. Fox in the next episode, this is him like discovering the limitations of what he knows about how to create movie worlds. And I think Fantastic Mr. Fox will kind of change how he looks at movies.
Yeah, that's a little hint.
But this is like him like being like, okay, I can control this train, but like I don't know how I can control other things and make a world in India where like I don't know anything. Like I don't know how this place works.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So like I do think it's interesting to talk about with his career, but like you said, just watching it. I mean, both times I've seen this movie, I was like awake throughout the first 40 minutes, and then once they get off the train, I start like getting really tired. And I'm like, that can't be a coincidence. First time, maybe I was just tired,
just feels
but the second
so
time
hefty.
It's like, man, this is rough. This is pretty slow right now.
Yeah, I think what is so interesting is I think this, and I mean, I like Life Aquatic a lot, But I think this and Life Aquatic do have some similar maybe flaws in it, in like the way that it's paced or the way it feels slower and not as,
yeah, they both,
like,
feel slower for sure.
Because I think Tenenbaums is very, like, there's lots of montages. It's very quick, 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 quick. Like, these are the characters. Boom, boom, boom. Narrator telling the story. And I think that this one doesn't function that way. And it's interesting to see his turnaround from this, where he basically, like, had... Not that Life Aquatic was a flop, but it kind of was. And this was also sort of a flop in a way. Like, if people like the short film better than the main film...
It made money, but it was a critical flop, too. So, like, it's still,
yeah,
I think, maybe
so
in his mind was, like, not as good.
You have to think, with those two paired together, the way that he leaned more into the Tenenbaum style, I feel like, moving forward. Because if you look at something else, I feel like, you know, Grand Budapest, like, I feel like that feels more like Tenenbaums than it does Aquatic or this one. So it's interesting to see what worked for him and what didn't, and that, like, he kind of pulled away from some of these things that didn't work in these two movies, which shows his resilience as an artist, I think.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it shows in, like, audience reactions, because, like we said, like, Life Aquatic and I think Darjeeling Limited both are not talked about as much, I think, if you talk to, like, just people that are, if you think of Wes Anderson or maybe ask someone about a movie. But pretty much, like, Tenenbaums and then everything after Darjeeling Limited, I think people talk about a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
At least people that aren't maybe just, like, really, like cinephile, like Wes Anderson.
Sure.
Big super fans. I mean, yeah, I think, like, if you told someone, like, hey, you want to watch Darjeeling Limited with me, they would have no idea what you were talking about.
Yeah,
like,
or they
no
would say,
clue.
No, definitely not. Let's watch.
Yeah, they're like, what's
Moonrise
that about
Kingdom?
The tea? Yeah, right. Yeah, I also think we can not talk about this a ton, but we'll have to definitely talk about the Isle of Dogs, like the cultural appropriation stuff.
Sure.
In this one, I think it's actually a little bit different, because I feel like sometimes, who knows, like, I can't really say, like, if this is right or not, you know, but I do think it works more with the story, because it's more about, like, how Americans view traveling a lot, especially in the beginning when they're like, oh, look, where's my power adapter? Let me get my nuts, my savory snacks. Like, it's definitely, it's kind of goes with that, where, like, the train is, like, them still trying to, like, hold on to, like, their Americanized ideals. And then, like, when they leave the train, they're a lot more open to other and I think it's a lot more authentic after that. So I feel like it kind of sometimes does go with it, because the point is that this is, like, through an American lens, these people are viewing India, and not through, like, a traditional lens. So I think, but I, like I said, not many people really talk about this movie a lot. So I just think it's an easy target if you're trying to talk about, like, the cultural appropriation stuff. But I feel like there's more of that in other movies than there is.
Yeah.
In this movie.
Sure. It's a good
another of his movies, not, like, other movies in general.
Yeah, that's something I haven't, like, really thought about or read about. That thing specifically with this movie, like you said, like, it's not talked about as much with this movie. Like, I've seen stuff about it in Isle of Dogs, but, like, I haven't seen any of that conversation with this movie, which just goes to show that, like, people don't talk about this movie as much. Or, like, care about this movie as much.
I think if this was popular, they probably would. But, like I said, I think it's, like, that might be somewhat the idea of it. And I do think, like, he obviously has a lot of inspiration from Indian films. Like, the music is not, this is the first music that's not by Mark Mothersbaugh. Mm. It's all, like, various Indian film composer.
Sure.
Like, taken from other Indian films. And, like, I think more than Isle of Dogs, for sure, you can tell he has, like, a more understanding of this culture. And it feels more in the story in this movie. So I just wanted to mention that, too, because I think I have seen some people talk about that. And I think the only thing I've really seen a lot is, like, the yellow color grading, which I think is more just unfortunate, because that he just styles everything, like, yellow. Like, the hotel short is yellow, but unfortunately, filmmakers just like to style, like, other, like, Eastern countries yellow. I just think that's just like, yeah. He did that because he just likes yellow, but not because like it's India.
I saw a TikTok of this girl who went to India or Mexico or, you know, a country that's not a Western country. And she was like, what the hell? The sky is blue here? Like, it was so funny. Yeah, like, yeah. She just, it was like, the sky's not yellow? Like, that's so true, though.
Oh,
yeah,
my
but,
goodness.
I mean, I think Tenenbaums is a very, like, yellowy, pinky,
yeah.
Like, highlight.
Like, he likes yellow.
Well.
Like,
but,
just a big yellow
yeah,
guy.
Yeah, it's an interesting point.
Needle drops, there's not, like, a ton, actually, in this. There's only, like, a couple, like, big ones, but I really like the beginning, the This Time Tomorrow, the Kinks one.
Yeah.
I think, and it's like, it opens it. I mean, I think this ends actually maybe with them running in slow motion in the song, Kinks song too. But at least this one is different as the opening. And it definitely, when I rewatched it, I was like, man, maybe this movie is really good. Cause like that needle drop was just so cool. I was like, man, this might be a new favorite.
There's a couple Kinks
I like
songs
that song.
In this one.
Yeah. I think three, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
And the first Rolling Stones song that was credited, because the Rolling Stones are very picky about who gets to put their songs in their soundtrack. So I think there were in other songs, but this is the first one that was on the soundtrack.
Interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, I like that first one, I guess, if I had to pick one. And I like that song a lot, so.
Yeah, I like that one too.
And I just, something about running in slow motion to catch up to a train just looks pretty cool, I gotta say. Like, throwing the bag on. And also, you see in the beginning, he's throwing the bag on. That's like his first thing that he cares about is his father's bag. But then in the last scene, they have to drop the bags because they're letting go of material possessions.
Wow.
But they're still on the train. So it's like they haven't fully, like, learned yet. Then, like, they go through all the same motions in the end. Yeah. I think it's cool to talk about, but I just, when I watch it,
yeah,
it doesn't work out as well.
The concept versus the execution. That's all it is in this movie for me, is I love the concept. I like the characters. I like the conflicts the characters are having.
Yeah.
But I don't like the film, you know? I don't like the way that it's translated into this movie, particularly in the second half, but
yeah, I actually think this is one of Owen Wilson's like funniest characters. Like, when I was like, some of his funny moments are really funny. Like when he takes the passport, he's like, give me your passport, why are you leaving? It's just so funny. He's funny. And it's interesting, this is like his last big role in a Wes Anderson movie, right?
Yeah, I believe
so. Like, because all the other ones are like just smaller cameo, so, you know. Rough that it was this one, but I think Life Aquatic was like a good one too, so
yeah.
He got that one in too. I feel like final thoughts, we kind of already talked a lot about, through the whole thing, we talked about like how they all connect and everything and where his career goes, so I feel like we kind of covered this.
Yeah, so. I think so. Do we want to like share our rankings? Do you have an updated ranking?
Yeah, good call. Yeah, I have it, I think, memorized. So right now it is Rushmore at the top, and then Tenenbaums, and then Life Aquatic, and then Bottle Rocket, and then Darjeeling Limited. And like, there's a big gap after Aquatic to Bottle Rocket and Darjeeling. Like, there's a gap. Like a star gap in between there.
Sure.
But yeah.
So, mine and I have Life Aquatic at the top, then Tenenbaums, then Rushmore, then Darjeeling, then Bottle Rocket.
Wow. I think all of ours are in different places, except for Tenenbaums. Yeah, Tenenbaums are both our number two. But other than that, everything is different. So
yeah, and
I think after this, we agree a lot more on the movies, though.
Yeah, I think we still have different rankings, though. But like, we do agree more, but I do think we have different, different rankings still.
Yeah, this is like definitely different than Star Wars, where like we basically had
the
like the same top three,
same,
right?
Yeah, we did. Yeah,
I don't think that's
gonna
happen
funny.
Today. That's not gonna happen this time.
No, I don't think so.
I guess, yeah, makes more interesting content, you know. All right, cool. So I think with that, our question of the week this week should be, what song would score the final slow motion sequence in a movie about you?
Wow. I'm going to think on it, and I'll come back with my answer.
L to the OG.
Next week. That would be L to the OG. You would be the OG.
Walking off.
And he playing.
Would be a great meme. I think the best one would be
Man or Muppet.
Well, no, I'm trying to, like, maybe like the Rushmore scene would be cool, like to put like a song over the ending of a Wes Anderson movie, like one of those scenes, like L to the OG of them running on the dock in Life Aquatic.
Yeah. Like, that would be like a good Twitter like account, you know, the Twitter accounts where it's like this scene to a song, and then people will probably you the song. Like they're running in slow motion, and it's like, born on the North Bank, king of the East Side.
Oh my goodness. They're running to catch the train. L to the OG. Dude be the OG. Man.
And then it would be great because it would be like, never stop going, fuck Father Time, while they're like running and trying to catch the train. Like,
hey, you know, Royal Tenenbaums, like we said, is like Succession. Maybe they leave the graveyard to L to the OG.
Oh man.
Imagine like the gate closing to like it goes into North Kendall's King of the East Side.
Honesty.
That's the credits. The credits are the Billy Joel. Oh my goodness.
Gosh. I'll think of a
all people that don't watch Succession are really confused right now.
What is going on?
Sorry. My bad. I don't know what mine would be. I would think, I mean, there's a lot of Beatles songs you could use, probably, you know.
Yeah.
You know what? I mean, this was used in Boogie Nights already. That was a big one, but I think God Only Knows would be a pretty great final movie song. It's a pretty great song. Also, maybe something like a Bob Dylan song, you know? Hey, that'd be cool. Girl from the North Country, maybe. Visions of Joanna, that would be fun.
Love in the Time of Socialism by Yellow House.
Oh, yeah, you sent me that song. That would be a good one. That's a nice finality to it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, right now, I know, you've been listening to the Rex Orange County album, right? Have you?
Yeah.
Like, you know that the last song on that one, Who Cares? That one would be pretty cool. That'd be a great one.
Yeah, you know? That would be good.
That has a nice, like, more a lot of really very positive, you know, that one. Yeah.
There's a couple songs on that album that I think would be good.
Mm. Do you think Wes Anderson listens to Rex Orange County? Do you think he's a big ROC guy?
Interesting. I could see him
listening. He probably
would
like his early stuff.
Yeah, I could see him listening to, like, Tame Impala or, like, Wallows.
Do you think he tells people that Tame Impala is only one person?
I just feel like that's the kind, like, he just gives me those vibes, you know, like,
man,
like, I'm a cool guy, I know indie music, and then it's like Tame Impala and you're like, oh great.
I would love to see Wes Anderson Spotify.
I would too.
That would be like, if I could have like a wish, that'd be pretty, like maybe top 20.
I bet he's an Apple Music guy.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe just his playlist.
Maybe he's a Pandora guy.
I want to see
maybe
Pandora now, right? Is that what it is? That actually was so true. Like, he does it, like, he just shuffles playlists based on artists, like the Kinks playlist, but, like, he doesn't know how to pick a Kinks song. Uh-huh. So, like, he just plays the Kinks radio on Pandora. It has the ads for it.
Rolling
He's like, man,
Stones radio.
I'm waiting for my song.
That's
man,
so
that's
funny.
So funny. That, wow. Drop your iPhone home screen layout, please. Yeah. Wes, drop the layout.
Speaking of soundtracks, next week,
oh,
we've got a movie that I'm assuming will have some good needle drops in it. One can hope.
Yeah.
And that is Marvel's
Minions Rise of Gru.
Minions Rise of Gru. Which also has a banger soundtrack, not gonna lie.
Yeah, it does. It does. No, that's not what we're
doing. It'll be Thor Love and Thunder. So we'll be talking about that.
Reviews are mixed, gotta say.
I have seen a lot of ups and downs on this one.
Will we love it or will we rage with thunder?
Based on the people's opinions that I align with, I was very much looking forward to this one for the most part. I'm not sure how I'm going to feel now, because there's a couple people that have posted stuff that I've been like, ooh, if they're saying that they don't like certain things, I think that I would feel the same way as them. So that
I guess we'll see.
We'll see.
Very interested. Like, yeah, I'm very interested to see. We didn't say this, but so like that question of the week, you can answer that on any of our social medias, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. On Spotify, there's a feature. You can email us. Everything's in the show notes, so answer that question there. And then we'll read that in that Thor Love and Thunder review. Which, yeah, next Tuesday, Thor Love and Thunder. Let's see how we feel. Anything else to say until that point?
No.
Well, all right then. Thank you all for listening. And until next time, I'm Noah Tenenbaum.
Ooh, and I'm Kayla Whitman.
And we're
Your second
hand film critics.